And this evening, I'm going to share with you my personal journey. It's called Yankee Sandinista. That's the name of a book that was written by a man who was a Vietnam War protester that eventually went to live in Denmark. And he visited Nicaragua in 1984, and he wrote a book about U.S. citizens living in Nicaragua. And one of the people that he wrote about was me. There were quite a few of us in the book, maybe about 14. And there are two of us in the book that had a long experience of living in Nicaragua. I don't like to talk about myself, but if sharing with you people this evening can help bring about some understanding of why people make some of the options that they do, then I'm glad to share my story with you. I was born in Minnesota quite a few years ago, at the end of 1939. And I was born into, I was the first child of my parents who were not poor, but I would say not very well to do. They were hardworking folk, and I was brought up by my Irish Catholic mother in the Catholic Church. My father was a Congregationalist. And from the time I was a very small girl living out in the countryside, in Eureka, close to Excelsior, Minnesota, I wanted to be a religious person. Now, a lot of little Catholic girls want to be sisters. You know, I think that's a stage that a lot of us go through. Somehow or other, that motivation, that religious motivation, stayed with me through the years. When I was 13, I wanted to go to the convent, and my father wouldn't let me go, which was very wise of my father. You know, what's a 13-year-old girl going to do in the convent? So I went to the woods, and I cried a lot about it. But I decided, well, that's all right. And I went back to being a tomboy. I wanted to be a doctor when I was that age. And I think that I thought it would be interesting to be a doctor and be a missionary and work somewhere in the world helping people. No? I'm sure that a lot of you share the same kind of motivation and had these kinds of wishes and fantasies when you were little kids too. When I was about 14, I started working in Minneapolis General Hospital. I was a Girl Scout. Some of you were Girl Scouts? Great preparation for life. I was a Girl Scout, and I went to work in Minneapolis General Hospital as a laboratory aide. And during those years that I worked in the laboratory, I was fortunate to have men and women around me who really encouraged me in wanting to be a physician. And this, remember, is many years ago. When I wanted to be a physician, very few women were allowed into medical school. In fact, at that time, only 7 of 100 places in medical school were filled with women. There was a quota system. When I was in high school then and working in the hospital, I had my first contact with American Indians because the hospital I worked in was an indigent hospital. And so I began to see poor people, poor white people, poor Indian people, poor black people. But because I would go around and chart in the evenings, I got to know a lot of these people, not just by their laboratory tests. It's not like today where the computer runs it off to the patient's chart. You know, we had to go around and we had to meet patients and talk to them. And that was really important because that was my opportunity to know a whole group of people in the society that as a young person, 14, 15, 16 years old, normally I wouldn't have that kind of opportunity. And so I had my first contact then with people who lived in a situation of poverty and were not accepted by the rest of the society very, very well, let us say. And I found that there were people that really made a strong impression upon my life, people who were patients in that hospital and people who were working in that hospital. Eventually, I went to the University of Minnesota, and together with other young people at the university, I belonged to an organization that was called International Brothers and Sisters. And we worked with foreign students that came to the University of Minnesota. And one day, another friend of mine at the university, who was in student government with me, said, we ought to be doing something with the Indian people from our state. Because the Indians in Minnesota were just beginning to enter the University of Minnesota, and they were foreign students. They were foreign students in their own state university because of their cultural difference with the vast majority of us who were at the university. So we expanded our foreign student program and became involved with our brothers and sisters from the state of Minnesota who were Indians. And I guess that's when I really wanted to become much more involved with Indian people and learn from them. When I was a junior in the university, between my junior and senior year, I did a study program. By this time, I was really heavily into pre-med and all that means, because it was at that time, and I imagine continues to be, extremely competitive. And you have to get in medical school, so you're competing with all these people. Instead of learning to care about one another, you're competing with one another for grades. No? But between my junior and senior year, I went off to Southeast Asia on a study program. I designed a study program, and I went to Washington and sold the director of the World Health Organization on the idea, and he let me go to Southeast Asia. And years later, when I met him, when he was the dean of the School of Public Health at Michigan, he remembered who I was, because nobody ever had the rashness of going to the director of the World Health Organization and asking him to help set up a study program. He thought that was really something. But in any case, that's what I did. I went off to Southeast Asia and I stayed there for 4 months working, studying what the World Health Organization was actually doing. And if their programs, which were at national levels, had any impact in the communities. And of course, what I learned is that very few of them had any impact in the local community. These were international programs working with ministries of health, and very little trickle-down happened. But it did happen in a couple of places. And it didn't happen because of physicians or nurses. It happened because there were people doing health education. And so suddenly I was faced with the dilemma. I wanted to be a doctor, but what were the doctors doing that I met both in the United States and in Southeast Asia? They were doing curative care. They were repeatedly taking care of the same kinds of illnesses. Whereas in this program where I met people working in primary health care and health education, they were having some impact because they were helping to change attitudes and to change practices. And so I went back and I wrote my paper for my advisor, who happened to be the head of the School of Public Health at the University of Minnesota, Dr. Gaylord Anderson. And Dr. Anderson said, you know, you really don't belong in medical school. You belong in the School of Public Health. But I was very stubborn, and I said, no, I still want to be a doctor. And he said, well, we'll see. Why don't you just come and take some courses in your last year of college? And really, Dr. Anderson, who was one of the first people in public health in the United States, he was at one time the director of public health in the state of Massachusetts, and one of the old men of public health in the United States, slowly but surely convinced me, by having me participate in his classes and his seminars, that I should be a public health worker and not a doctor. Now, I'm sure that most of you know doctors. You deal with them on a fairly regular basis. And you know that doctors have a great deal of status. And probably very few of you know people who work in public health, because public health has very little status. Well, I wasn't worried about status. I was worried about what I could do to really have some sort of impact on what was causing disease, causing illness in our communities here and in other places in the world. I eventually decided not to go to medical school after I'd been accepted to three schools. And so then my friends were sure I had lost my mind. Because 2 weeks before medical school started, I went to Dr. Anderson and I said, I want to go to the School of Public Health. Well, that's the best thing I ever did. Because that gave me the opportunity to use the skills that I had as an individual, you know, my interests in natural sciences and social sciences and humanities, all in one profession, which was public health education. And I said, I want to go to the School of Public Health, but I'm going to put conditions on your letting me go to school. And so I said, I want to do my field work. Yeah, I was very brash. I want to do my field work with the Indians. And so, of course, he let me. And I went off and did 9 months of field work with the Pueblo Indians in New Mexico. And that was another very fortunate part of my life. I became closely involved with people to whom I have relationships to this very day. And while I was there, I decided to write my master's thesis on migrant workers. And this was in 1961, 1962. And I felt that one could work in public health and make some sort of impact if the work was done in terms of community organization. No. That we have to organize people in order to have change take place in communities. And so I did write my thesis about that. And in 1963, the Migrant Health Act was passed by the federal government, and I began working with migrant workers in the state of Texas. Now, are any of you from Texas? Yes, you know where Lubbock is. It's way out there in West Texas. It's not exactly like Minnesota. And I think that while I had this wonderful experience of working in New Mexico with the Indians, to move and live in a community like Lubbock, Texas, was really a tremendous cultural shock for me. Because I was working with Mexican Americans, I had to stay on the other side of the tracks. Because the people who lived in Lubbock, the white West Texans, didn't want anything to do with the Mexicans or anybody who had anything to do with the Mexicans. So suddenly, I encountered what many people encounter daily. I encountered racism. Racism because I was working with people. Well, fine. I wanted to work with them and I liked the work. And part of that led me to become involved with the Cesar Chavez and the Farm Workers Union. He was in California, but there were people working on farm labor organization in Texas. Well, I stayed in Texas for 5 years, working at the health department in Lubbock, and later in the lower Rio Grande Valley, working for the state of Texas. Working for the state of Texas during the day, and working for the farm workers movement during the night. And this didn't seem to be such a contradiction for me, because I felt that my skills as a community health worker and organizer were really important for the farm workers movement. And it really wasn't strange either, if you consider where I had come out of. I came out of Minnesota from a strong Democratic Farm Labor Party background. No? Some of you probably know about that, how that was in those days. It's not like that anymore, unfortunately. But during the time that I was in Texas, I was approached by the Peace Corps to train Peace Corps volunteers. And eventually, in 1968, I was recruited by the Peace Corps to go to Latin America. And it was like, well, finally my dream is going to come true. I'll be able to go and do work in health education and in organization in another country. And I felt the time was right, because having worked with the farm workers, I felt that I had become so identified with the struggle of the farm workers that it was pretty hard for me to do my work in the state health department with the growers, because those were the people I had to work with, trying to convince them that they should make life a little better for the laborers. Somebody was just commenting today on how even today farm worker living conditions are very difficult. And of course, that continues to be a problem. But I decided to accept the opportunity to be a Peace Corps staff member. And I thought I was going to the Andean countries, to Ecuador, or to Peru, or to Bolivia, with the Incas. Well, I got a call one day from Washington, and they said, we would like you to go to Nicaragua. And I said, but Nicaragua's a dictatorship. Peace Corps can't go there. And if some of you recall, the first director of the Peace Corps was Sergeant Shriver. And Sergeant Shriver considered Nicaragua a dictatorship, and he wouldn't send Peace Corps volunteers there. But the new director of the Peace Corps was the ex-ambassador of the U.S. government in Panama, and he knew Somoza, the dictator. And he reclassified. He and the State Department worked on the reclassification of Nicaragua. And by 1968, it was no longer a dictatorship. It was a limited democracy. And so Peace Corps could go there. Now, if I seem sarcastic, you'll see the reasons why. So I thought, well, all right, I'll take this on. There was another reason I wanted to take it on. Peace Corps in Latin America never had hired a woman for the position that I was going to have, because Latin America is an area of the world where there's lots of machismo. You know what that is? Mm-hmm. Yeah, the women especially, though, right? Well, lots of machismo. And they wouldn't put women in responsible positions in the Peace Corps. This is 1968, mind you. And so I said, well, I better accept this challenge, and I went. And I went to Nicaragua with the intention of working with the Peace Corps, setting up a Peace Corps program, and trying to do the best job I could. I went there with an open mind of trying to learn about Peace Corps and a new country and be a responsible person, right? Well, I wasn't there very long when I knew something wasn't
Right.
Something was seriously wrong in this country. And in 1968, Nixon was elected President of the United States. And immediately, we who were staff members of the Peace Corps became members of the country team. Now, up to this time, Peace Corps had said that it was not a branch of U.S. foreign policy. But when a staff member of the Peace Corps becomes a member of a country team of the embassy, that's pretty close to being involved in U.S. foreign policy. In other words, yes, we were. And definitely in Nicaragua, we were involved in U.S. foreign policy. And I didn't like this. I didn't like thinking that people were coming into a country believing that they were being representatives of the United States and working with the Nicaraguan people for their good, when I saw that there were political intentions behind this on the part of the government of the United States and the president of Nicaragua, Chismosa. When we were oriented to Nicaragua, we were told that there was no longer a revolutionary movement in Nicaragua, that this revolutionary movement had been destroyed in the early 60s, and by the time that I got there, there was no evidence that this long existed anymore. Well, in the work that I was doing with the Peace Corps, I had a lot of contact with the university, and the university students and an institute at the university were involved in helping us to orient Peace Corps volunteers. And so I got to know some people really well. And on different occasions, I was invited to go out to the countryside and see work that was being done and to get to know better the Nicaraguan countryside, not just where I was setting up sites for Peace Corps volunteers, but other kinds of experiences that were going on in Nicaragua that were not really very well known to the Peace Corps. And in the course of this, I had the opportunity to work with two or three young men who were at the Instituto Juan 23, the John 23rd Center at the Jesuit University. And one day I received a phone call, and I was called into the U.S. Embassy, and the political officer was sitting at his desk, and I will never forget this, because I was looking out of a window, and on the other side of a volcanic lake was the presidential palace. This is before the earthquake of 1972. So there was this presidential palace, and I mean palace, that's what they called it, that's what it was. And below that palace, in the hillside, in the volcanic hillside, there were dungeons, prisons. And one of my friends that I knew at the university had told me about the time that he had spent in that dungeon and the reasons why he was there. And so this man was sitting there talking to me, and he said, "I want you to become an informer for us. We want you to report on the activities of your friends at the university." Now, I want you to know this, because a lot of people don't believe that Peace Corps was used for spying purposes or informing purposes, because its charter says that it would never be used in that way, and people will deny it. But I was approached by the country director of the CIA and asked to become an informant, and I refused to do so. And I not only refused to do so, I went and told my friends that I had been asked to inform about them, and would they please be careful. So, that doesn't sit well with the U.S. Embassy. when somebody says no. But I had my position and I was doing my work correctly as far as my work, right? I mean, I wasn't hired to be a spy. I was hired to be a Peace Corps associate director. So I did my work and they didn't like it, but I did it and I did it well. When my time came, well, actually, there was another important event. In 1969, in July, I had been in Nicaragua for about 1 year. One afternoon, I heard tanks coming past our office. And then I heard airplanes flying over. And all of a sudden, this whole area where we had our office, which was very close to the palace and to the presidential palace and to the headquarters of the National Guard, all of a sudden this whole area was totally militarized and something was happening. And for the rest of that afternoon, we heard a tremendous battle going on. And we all wondered, what is really happening? Later that evening, and this is the strange part of the things that Somoza did, later that evening, on television, we watched as one person held off 400 National Guardsmen for over a 3-hour period. And that person's name was Julio Buitrago. And he was a member of the Frente Sandinista, the Sandinista Liberation Front. And this was an organization that supposedly didn't exist. But that day, in two different parts of the city of Managua, there were heated battles between the National Guard and members of the Sandinista Liberation Front. And so, from that day on, I believed in the Sandinista Liberation Front, and I believed in it as an alternative for the Nicaraguan people. Because people who have that courage to fight off the National Guard believe in something very strongly. And then I began to realize why it is they wanted me to be an informant. And that maybe some of my friends were involved in other things that I wasn't quite sure about. Well, it wasn't until actually about 3 years ago that I discovered the real reasons why they wanted me to be an informant. It turned out that one of my friends' wives was the only person who knew the whereabouts of Carlos Fonseca when he was hiding. Carlos Fonseca was the founder of the Frente Sandinista. And I never realized until just 3 years ago how close I had been to Carlos Fonseca. And thank God I didn't become an informant. So, anyway, I was convinced by that time that yes, there was something very meaningful here. Because I was living in the injustice, I saw what was happening in Nicaragua, I saw how we were being utilized, and I believed that the people had to struggle for their liberation. When I finished working for the Peace Corps in 1970, I became a lay missioner. I went to the east coast of Nicaragua and I worked with the Capuchin priests from Wisconsin, the Sisters of St. Agnes, and the Moravian Mission. I worked on the east coast of Nicaragua in a project that was funded by Oxfam of England. And it was a project where we were working with the communities on the Rio Colpa, the Mosquito Indian communities. 350 miles of river, 54 villages, totally isolated from the rest of the country. Our only means of transportation were the little pangas, or the little boats that we had with motors on them. And we developed, over a period of years, a leadership training program whereby Mosquito Indian villagers were able to assume responsibilities for a lot of activities in their own villages. We help people develop skills as health workers. We gave training to the midwives, basic training about hygiene. I've talked about this in other sessions about respecting and recognizing the validity of the practices of the people and building upon their beliefs and practices and helping them do their job better. We also worked with agriculturalists, and we worked with religious leaders. We worked with the Smalsmaka, or teachers of the Moravian Church, and with the catechists of the Catholic villages. The villages were sort of divided. They were either Catholic or Moravian. But we all worked together in this leadership training program, and we helped people in the villages learn about their civic responsibilities. We taught them about the constitution of the country and what the constitution guaranteed for them as citizens of Nicaragua. Well, that was not correct. It was not right for us to teach the constitution, apparently. Our Catholic priest that I worked with, Capuchin priest, had been doing liberating education or popular education with the Indians for some years. And he had translated the Constitution into the Miskito language and the Sumo language. And we were working on discussing the Constitution with Indian leaders, with these leaders that we had been training. And so there came an order from the National Guard. We were to no longer teach the Constitution, that the materials that we were distributing on the river were subversive materials. Yeah? We were working with the Constitution. Well, by this time I had married an Indian man, and I had one child, and I was pregnant with another child. And I was supposed to go upriver on a plane because I was pregnant with my son, Marcelo, who you've seen around here. And I couldn't take the boat up the river. And the plane never came. And I couldn't understand what was going on. And so I communicated by radio with my colleagues that I was working with on our leadership training team. And they said, "You are casa por cárcel." Casa por cárcel means that I was under house arrest. I didn't know I was under house arrest, but very soon I was informed by a friend of mine who came up from the Puerto Cabezas, the site of the National Guard headquarters on the East Coast of Nicaragua, and told that I was going to be kicked out of the country. And so I got on the next plane and I went to Managua and I spoke to the Minister of Health. I was the director of the health center in Waspam. And I told him, "We're running a quite good program that Oxfam of England is paying for, and it's the only alternative for people on the river, this program, in terms of health and other aspects of training." Well, one of the doctors who was in the Ministry of Health was from the East Coast, and he believed in what we were doing. And so he interceded with the government so that I could stay until the end of 1974. In February of 1975, I left Nicaragua as persona non grata. And I didn't return to Nicaragua until after the Sandinista trial in 1979, and permanently in 1981. So I went to Guatemala. I sort of jumped out of the frying pan into fire. In 1975, though, Guatemala was not a country where there was a great deal of civil unrest. In fact, it seemed to be a very peaceful place. And I began working in the highlands of Guatemala, doing work similar to what I had been doing before. Those of you who heard my discussion last night know that I spent years training community-based health workers. And so that's exactly the kind of work that I did in Guatemala. until one morning early on the 3rd or 4th of February of 1976, when everything came tumbling down. That was the earthquake in Guatemala. That night, 20,000 people were killed. 20,000 people were killed in that earthquake because of the social conditions, not because their houses were structures that were unsafe. But what it did is it laid open for many people to see the injustice that existed in the highlands, particularly of Guatemala. And so from 1976 until 1980, there was great ferment among people in the highlands of Guatemala. And eventually, this led to very serious involvement of Indian people in their struggle for liberation. And so, really, the earthquake changed my work, you might say, from being simply a trainer of health promoters to being a serious organizer of people around justice issues. And we worked in reconstruction of communities in the entire highlands of Guatemala. And the people that I did that with were all people with strong Christian commitment. We had in Guatemala a prayer group, that was made up of people who were Lutherans and Methodists and Episcopalians and Catholics, including a Catholic priest and two sisters, and a woman from England and a Lutheran doctor. And over the years we worked together in our daily work, but we also prayed together about what was the meaning of what was happening to us and to the communities in which we were involved. And some of us decided to make an even more firm commitment to the people and accompany them in their struggle for liberation and to suffer the consequences. Well, in Guatemala, if you make those kinds of commitments, you have to risk your life. You have to be willing to give your life. And many people did. The priest that I worked with was going one day to his parish when some of his parishioners met him on the road and told him to turn around because they were waiting to kill him in his parish church. And shortly after that, two of the sisters, one of them who was 70 years old, were captured by the army and were held and tortured for about a 3 or 4 day period until, because there was international clamor, then they were released. Now, they were released because people spoke out, because they were important. They were U.S. citizens, they were religious people, and there were groups that would be advocates for them. But how many Indian people died at the same time? Over the years then, my commitment was to give support to the Indian people and to accompany them in their struggle and to train them well for the work that they would have to do. And part of that was just knowing survival skills, knowing what to do when you were attacked by the army, knowing how to take care of people who have been injured. And I'm not talking about people who are carrying guns. I'm talking about people who live in villages and who would have army troops come through and just raid the villages and kill people. And you know, over the early years of the 60s, at the beginning of the 60s, over 400 villages were completely destroyed. Well, during these years, my children were little children, and one day, as they were going to school, and this would have been at the end of the 80s, 1980 was a terribly
dreadful year in Guatemala. That was the year of the Spanish embassy fire, when people went into the Spanish embassy asking that government and the Spanish embassy and a special commission investigate. Just go and look at the graves of people who had been killed in the countryside. And some of you know who Rigoberto Menchú is. She's a young Indian woman from Guatemala. At that time, she was a little Indian girl, and her father was a catechist. And he was a health promoter, and he worked with us. And so he and the other men who went to ask that this investigation be done were burned inside of the Spanish embassy. And after the Spanish embassy fire, then there was massive destruction of communities. And one day, as my children were coming home from school, as they were going to school, just a few miles from where we lived, we saw 7 people hanging from a tree. Now, that's pretty shocking to anybody, no? I mean, we were finding dead people on the roads every single morning. Now, I'm sharing this with you because this happened in Guatemala, but the same thing happened in Salvador, the same thing happened in Nicaragua. This is just my personal experience. Some of you may have seen the movie El Norte. That movie ends with one man hanging from a tree. Well, we saw 7. And after that, my children started having bad dreams. And they were afraid for us, and they had every reason to be. And so eventually, I sent them here to the States to spend some time with my brother and his family, and I continued to do my work, knowing that I had little time left. My husband returned to Nicaragua, and for the last 7 months that I lived in Guatemala, in 1981, I never slept in the same place 3 nights. I had to move every 3 days. What was I doing? I was training village-level people to know how to respond to situations of emergency in their communities. But that is not something that could be done legally. No. When I left Guatemala in 1981, I returned to Nicaragua. Some of you know who Ernesto Cardenal is? Well, Ernesto Cardenal is a Catholic priest, contemplative, and he's a poet and an author of many books. And he's my friend. And when I came back to Nicaragua, he told me that, he said, "Welcome once again to your liberated country." And I felt like I had come back home, and I felt really good. And so I began working with the Ministry of Health and training, again, people in basic primary health care, and working on the campaigns that the Sandinista government had been set up. And this was in 1981. In 1983, the war, the counter-revolutionary war, had begun. Began in probably 1982. In 1983, by the time that we decided to set up our own organization, people in communities over on Nicaragua were now being attacked, not by the National Guard of old, but by the counter-revolutionary forces that were supported out of Honduras by the United States government. Now, some of you know about the Contra War, and probably some of you don't know very much about it. But over a period of years, the U.S. government poured considerable funds into the support of counter-revolutionary forces, some of them ex-National Guard, others people who were dissatisfied and left, others who were simply mercenaries. And those people waged a war against the Sandinistas. But that war could never be won. And it could never be won because of the tremendous spirit of the Nicaraguan people, because they wanted the revolution to happen. They wanted it to continue. We had health care for all people. We had education for all people. We had social services and pensions. And this was in the midst of a war. In the midst of a war, at the height of the war, the budget for the Ministry of Health still was the highest, except for Cuba, of all the Latin American countries. No? The commitment was there to provide social services for people. But the story that was told in the United States was not what was happening in Nicaragua. Now, the interesting thing is, if you go out there and check the papers for the last few days, you know that the Iran gate is still in the newspapers. What was Iran gate? It was the way that the U.S. government financed the counter-revolutionary war against Nicaragua by trading arms for drugs. And the interesting thing is, today the people who are in power in Nicaragua, the president of the National Assembly is a former director of the counter-revolutionary forces in Nicaragua, and he was responsible for those drug business exchanges. We had no drugs in 1989 and 90 in Nicaragua. Now we have drugs in Nicaragua. And it shouldn't surprise anybody, because the people who are running the government are people who were running drugs. No? Well, in any case, I won't get into all that. Right now, at least. During the years of the war, we worked hard to help local communities and people in ministries at local level and regional levels develop skills similar to some of, we had workshops using some of the techniques that we've used here in the last couple weeks. We did sculpturing the other day here. Some of you were involved in the sculpturing, which is positioning of human beings, you know, to demonstrate and discuss power relationships and so on. Well, a lot of these techniques we use and have been using in Nicaragua over the past 8 or 9 years. In 1983, with another person, I set up an organization, a non-governmental organization. We've grown from 2 people to 54. We have 4 offices around Nicaragua. And we try to, we have much more to do now than we had to do 2 or 3 years ago because of the policies of the new government. In any case, during those years of the war, there were many U.S. citizens who made an option of coming to Nicaragua. Some of them did it on a short-term basis. People would come and pick coffee or pick cotton, and I think there are people here. There's a young... You were there in Nicaragua?
For 2 weeks.
Yeah.
To celebrate the 10th anniversary.
Yeah, okay. Well, people came and wanted to learn about Nicaragua, and some people spent a short time. Some people worked in the fields and in coffee plantations. And others decided to stay longer, and we formed an organization of U.S. citizens working in Nicaragua. And after the Grenada invasion, when the U.S. government went into Grenada and took all those medical students out, do you remember that, anybody? No? Well, immediately after that, our organization began to have weekly vigils in front of the U.S. embassy, protesting U.S. foreign policy in Nicaragua and anywhere else where they were using their imperialistic tactics. And we spoke out weekly, and many people came in delegations with the Center for Global Education, with the Presbyterian Church, with the National Council of Churches. Many thousands and thousands and thousands of people came. And last night we were talking about what can people do about policy. Well, we believe the fact that so many U.S. citizens came to Nicaragua and saw for themselves what the Sandinistas were doing. We believe that those voices back here in the United States were very instrumental in preventing an out-and-out invasion of Nicaragua by the U.S. government. But over those years, there wasn't a family in Nicaragua that wasn't affected in some way or the other by the war. People were affected either because they had sons or daughters who were Sandinista fighters, who were in the military service, or they had sons or daughters who had gone with the counter-revolution. There wasn't a family that wasn't affected in some way or another. And even our family was affected, no? Because one of the people who was very close to us and actually worked with us in our institution was Ben Linder. And some of you probably know who Ben Linder was, those of you especially from here in the Northwest, in Portland. Well, Ben Linder was one of my closest and dearest friends in Nicaragua. And he was killed by the counter-revolution. And he was killed because there was an order to kill him. And his family and his friends have tried to have that brought before justice here in the United States. And it's not been accepted by the courts. But they will continue to struggle because even the people who were involved in the action against Ben admit that the order came for them to kill Ben Linder. Now, Ben Linder is just one person, but he is a person who made a tremendous impact upon this country because of what his family did to bring home here to the States the truth about what was going on in Nicaragua. What about the thousands of people who have died in Nicaragua? What about the thousands and thousands of people who have died in Salvador or in Guatemala? We react when it's a North American. We reacted when the religious sisters were killed in Salvador. We also reacted when the Jesuits were killed, no? Well, most of the Jesuits who were killed were actually Spanish Jesuits. No. But what I want to say is that over the years, thousands and thousands of people in Central America, which is not very far from here, have given their lives because of something that they believe in. And the interesting thing about this is that those Nicaraguans or those Salvadoranians or those Guatemalans who have given their life, most of them have given it in the spirit of wanting the liberation of their people and looking especially to the Old Testament, to Isaiah and to Jeremiah for their justification of their actions. No. For their belief in their liberation comes from their commitment as Christians. And I think that this is very important to understand because we're fed all of this business about these being Marxist, Leninist revolutionaries. Like that's something wrong, no? And we're made to believe that they're sort of savage and violent people. Who are the savage and violent people? They're the people who run our military establishment and who pay for this kind of destruction of peoples and homes and villages and societies, and who want to destroy Indian communities, wipe out totally the cultures of the people. No? The real savages for me are the people who are responsible for these kinds of policies, and not the revolutionaries who are struggling for a new and just and better society for their people. So, it's a long journey. It's a long journey from Minnesota, from Eureka, to being a Yankee Sandinista in Nicaragua. And what I've learned, I guess, over the years is that
the most important thing in this world is our struggle for justice. That if we believe in the gospel and believe in loving one another, that love we can express on an individual basis. We can work together and we can love one another when we know each other. But it's a lot harder to say that I'll fight for social justice when we don't know everybody, when we're talking about communities and societies. But that one-to-one love that we have and that we share can be expressed and worked for within societies. And I think that when I think back upon the things that have really been important for me in the years that I've lived in Latin America, those moments when I saw people's commitment to give their lives for other people, when Julio Buitrago was assassinated, fighting off the National Guard, and when other people have done these dramatic kinds of things, many people are called to look at this and analyze this and say, what does this mean for our lives? And so instead of destroying movements, what has happened is that, and we say this many times in our prayers, that the blood of those martyrs has been the seed, has been that which has fertilized those seeds of liberation in the societies of Central America. And the interesting thing is that it's not just Central America. It's everywhere where people are struggling for their liberation. People are fighting, they're dying for their belief in principles. And basically, if you look at them, many of them are the principles that we say are our Christian principles. And so sometimes it's hard for people to hear that. It's much easier, isn't it, Jonathan, that people think that these are our enemies. I said to somebody, if I had come to Holden Village only 4 years ago, we would have been the enemies. My children and I would have been the enemies of the United States. In fact, many of us that have made this commitment to the struggles in Central America or in other parts of the world are looked upon very badly by the State Department. And people said to me, well, why haven't you come to the United States and why haven't you talked about your experience? Well, if I come here and talk about my experience, somebody will come and say, well, you know, you shouldn't listen to her. She's a communist. And then just because they say I'm a communist, people will say, oh, no, we better not listen to her. Isn't that what happens? People are afraid of communism. But this is the value of, this is what Ben's life did for the people of Nicaragua. Ben's life and the commitment of his family and his friends to keep that project going in Nicaragua that Ben was working on. Just, who was it? Who's the lady that has the family? You have somebody working
on it.
Your son-in-law is working on the plant that Ben started when they assassinated him. He was doing the survey for the plant that her son-in-law is working on. People did not give up on that, no? And the important thing is that people don't give up. People didn't give up there, and people won't give up here. And what we have to do is put that in perspective and see what it means for our lives, no? I know what it meant for my life. My life is there. It's there with those people, and to continue that struggle, whatever that may mean. But for a lot of you, you have to decide where you put that energy, you know, where you make your commitment to those gospel values that you have. And I think that there are a lot of people here with very strong commitments toward justice, but perhaps less knowledge of what really is going on in the world. We have to get behind those stories, you know, get behind those images. I think it's important what Jonathan's talking about. And what I felt when I was sitting in his class the other day, he's
saying the same thing about the Middle East that I would say about Nicaragua, or that my friends in the Philippines would say about what's happening in the Philippines. It's happening all over the world. People are struggling for social justice, and they will continue to struggle, and they will continue to give their lives. And they see as their enemy those imperialistic kinds of actions of corporations and of governments. And unfortunately, the reason why a lot of people around the world don't like the U.S. government is because the U.S. government has as its principal policy the destruction of those kinds of movements. So, I've talked long enough. I just want you to know that it's very hard for me to talk like this about myself, and usually I don't do it, but if what my story has been can help you to understand that those of us who are struggling for social justice in other parts of the world are not some strange sort of character, no? I mean, I'm just like all of you. But God opened some doors for me and sent me on this journey. And if my journey can help any of you understand better the struggle of the many people of the world who are fighting for social justice and who are given their lives, then I'm happy to have done this. Thank you very much.